Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, Peter and Michael review Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike at the Paper Mill Playhouse and at the John Engman Theater in Northport. Peter also reviews The Road to Damascus at 59 East 59, and Michael gives us a preview of PBS's Shakespeare Uncovered. Matt Tamanini from Broadway World reviews Newsies at the Dr. Phillips Center for the Performing Arts in Orlando and also gives us a roundup of what's happening on television. Please stay tuned. Welcome to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for Monday, February 9th, 2015. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this evening, we have Peter Felicia, Michael Portantiere, and Matt Tamanini. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his latest being The Great Parade, to be released on April 7th, available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Kritzerland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Michael Portantiere is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talk in Broadway, The Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at foulspotphoto.com, as well as many other places on the internet. Matt Tamanini is Broadway World's chief TV and film critic. He also writes across other Broadway World sites, including Broadway World Orlando, and serves as Broadway World's database manager. So, Matt, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me, James. I always appreciate it.
Absolutely. So, tell me, yesterday, we're recording on, what is this, Monday night? We're recording on Monday night, so last night was the big Super Bowl. You know, what did you think of Idina's work?
Well, as I think I said a couple weeks ago, I was admittedly a little nervous about her doing the national anthem at what turned out to be the highest rated television event in the history of television. So I was a little nervous for her, but I have to say she did very well. There were no signs of the nerves that we've seen from her in previous big performances, New Year's Eve, the Oscars, the 2004 Tonys. She was great. I thought she delivered. The one complaint that I generally have with all diva-fied national anthems was that it probably took a little longer than it needed to. But the Super Bowl actually came out and said they asked her to try to get it to around 2 minutes and 4 seconds so that it could time up with flybys and all the special stuff they were doing in the stadium. And she did it exactly in 2 minutes and 4 seconds. So the slowness of it was a little annoying at times because it looks, you know, it always bugs me when anthem singers make it more about them and their performance than the song and the meaning and the patriotism. But there was good reason for this one. When you've got a bunch of military jets flying over, I guess you kind of have to stick to the allotted time. So other than it being a little slow, I thought she was fantastic. And probably my favorite part was after she finished, she clearly knew that she nailed it. And she was not shy about expressing her joy or relief or whatever that emotion was, because she pumped her fist and looked just as excited as all of us theater fans were for her.
Mm-hmm. Do you know the Forbidden Broadway version of Somewhat Overindulgent?
I don't. I know a lot of Forbidden Broadway stuff.
I'm going to have to send you that. It's Mandy Patinkin singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow, but he sings Somewhat Overindulgent. And I think that happens a lot in national anthems. And I'm so glad that you told me that they asked her to come in at 2:04, because I was wondering, you know, why she was going so slow. Oh. But you know, I think she did great. I think it did great. And although it's not really in our purview, is that the right word? I'm kind of a little under the weather here. But what did you think of the halftime show?
You know, I'll admit my age on a podcast radio. I'm 33 years old, and I guess I'm only 3 or 4 years older than however old Katy Perry is. And I would think that being that she's an attractive woman around my age, that I would enjoy it. But I just don't get it. I didn't get it. I don't get her personally. She kind of annoys me a little bit. But from the theatrical standpoint, I thought it was great. I thought the big, almost war horse-like lion that came in was pretty cool. And I loved the projections down onto the stage. I'm not exactly sure how they did it. It kind of reminded me of the opening ceremonies from the Olympics last year. So I thought the staging was very cool and everything. But I guess I don't get Katy Perry. I know a lot of people that I follow on Twitter that are theater people love her and loved it. Count me in the minority, I guess. I don't get Katy Perry, I guess.
So those projections are being that sort of technology is being used on Broadway
Is that Curious Incident?
Yes, Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. and various different shows here and there, which all of the names elude me right now. So, but I think that we're going to see that more and more often. It's really very cool technology.
Yeah, that was fascinating. That was very cool. And to see that it was so multifaceted to go from the chessboard to the beach, it wasn't like it was just individual squares that you could change to different colors. I mean, it was a full graphics projection that was, to me, more impressive than the actual performances were.
All right, so moving on, Emma Watson going to be doing Beauty and the Beast as Belle.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a surprise. To me, you know, we've seen these, we've seen Maleficent and we've seen the Cinderella that's coming out here in a couple months. So when they announced Emma Watson as playing Belle, it actually made sense to me. But then there was an insider that gave an interview to HitFix.com and said that Bill Condon, late of the Sideshow revival, who is directing it, his proposal to Disney when he was being interviewed to be the director for the movie is to include most, if not all, of the songs from the movie and from the Broadway version. So this is apparently going to be a live action musical version of Beauty and the Beast. So that kind of differed from the Maleficent and Cinderella's and kind of casts Emma Watson now as a much different Belle than I anticipated her being when she was first announced.
So the that type of thing, I saw that she posted on Twitter that she better start going to voice lessons now.
Yeah. I'm assuming that, look, she's been in a major public eye as an actress for almost all of her life. So I'm sure, much like Daniel Radcliffe, she's trained well and she's put a lot of time into her craft. This is another admission. I don't like Katy Perry, and I've never seen a Harry Potter movie in my life. So I can't really, you know, say how great of an actress she is, but I know that there are plenty of people that respect her as a performer. So I have no doubt that she's going to do just great. And if anything, based on Daniel Radcliffe, his performance on Broadway, he might not have been the best singer and dancer on Broadway, but one thing that you can say about him is that he worked extremely hard at it and dove into it. So if she even gives us half of that, I'm sure her Belle will be fantastic.
Did they give any time frame on this?
They haven't, but if you think about it, Maleficent came out, I guess, about a year and a half ago, and Cinderella's coming out in March. So I would imagine that filming would probably happen sometime in the next year for probably a summer or fall 2016 release, I would imagine. That's just me speculating, though.
So back to Idina. She's got a pilot coming up called Happy Time that was going to be produced by Ellen DeGeneres.
Yeah, this was announced on Friday, right before her Super Bowl appearance. She, you know, Ellen has been getting into a lot of TV producing. Besides her show, she's got a show that's actually debuting here this month. She's working on a show with Lauren Graham to turn her book into a TV show. And this is the next project that Ellen's working on. Idina's going to star in a pilot called Happy Time, where she is a woman who's in the public eye, who's a celebrity, who has always kind of been considered this happy, positive person. And she's kind of breaking away from that and showing that she's not the spunky, happy person that she is always viewed to be. And, you know, it's kind of interesting when you couple this with If Then. These things both kind of, you know, mirror what she's been going through personally in the last year and a half, where she's been, you know, pretty open about her, you know, her divorce and being a single mother and kind of breaking away from the persona that she might have had beforehand. So I think this will be great. I mean, anytime a theater star can get a television show and not just be the quirky sidekick or be a good guest star, I think that's good, not only obviously for them, but for theater in general, to kind of bring a little bit more credibility to the public as a whole.
And coming up, we have in TV land, Sutton Foster has got a new show What's it called? Younger?
It is called Younger. It's been interesting because this one has been pushed back a couple times, and I don't think, from what I've heard and I've read, it's not because of the quality of the show. TV Land, which, you know, when it started, to me, was always kind of a spinoff of Nick at Night. It showed old shows, old reruns, but now they're really trying to brand themselves with their new shows. They've had a couple for a few years, Hot in Cleveland with Betty White, and they've had a couple other shows, but this is kind of their first real effort at a more serious, thoughtful show. It is still going to be a comedy, but it's an hour-long show, and it's not going to be just a multi-cam filmed in front of a live studio audience show, but it is called Younger. Sutton Foster plays a recently divorced 40-year-old mother who is looking for the first time to kind of get back into the workforce, and through some different events gets hired at his job, but it's partially because they think she's 26 years old. So good for Sutton to be able to play the character who people think is 26 years old, but she, she kind of has to maintain that fake age that everybody thinks of her as, and so she kind of has to blend the line between truth and lying, but then also trying to realize that this this job is something that she has to do to be a single mother. So it also stars Hilary Duff and Debbie Mazur and Miriam Shore. Some of those are names familiar to theater people. So it should be a fun show. It debuts in March. It was originally supposed to debut in the fall, and then they pushed it back. We thought it was going to be January, and then about a week before it debuted in January, they pushed it back again until March. So hopefully that's the last pushback. I know that I believe the first season is completely filmed. So hopefully we will get to see it soon.
Wow. Do you know if that's based on a real story?
I don't know if it's, I don't believe it is. I believe it is based on a book called Younger. Let me pull it up here. It's a book by Pamela Redman Satran, Satran. I'm not familiar with the book, but it sounds like an interesting concept, especially for someone with the personality of Sutton. You can kind of see her in that role, just from her, her public persona that we've seen from her through the years as a theater star.
Yeah, there was I forget the details of it. I sort of remember that there was a woman who was passing herself off as early 20s or something like that. She was a television writer and she was really in her 40s. And
really,
it was about 4 or 5 years ago. And so it sounds similar, but not exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I did misspeak. Actually, it is a half an hour show. It is not an hour long show.
Oh,
so,
okay.
So I'll correct that. It is a half an hour dramedy, so to speak.
And then, we have, the ever present Nashville with, so many folks.
Well, yeah, it's a show that over the years, obviously it's, Nashville. I admit I have seen every episode of Nashville. It is one of my guilty pleasure TV shows. But over the years, it's gone from just having, a couple semi pretty big celebrities in Connie Britton and Hayden Panettiere who can sing decently enough to they've started to bring in some theater stars who can both act and sing to really bolster the cast. It started with Will Chase from Billy Elliot and Mystery of Edwin Drood and so many other shows, and Smash, late of Smash, of course. And then this season they brought in Tony Winner, Laura Benanti, and she's had a really nice arc as a young singer-songwriter. And actually, it's kind of ironic, the young man that plays Will Chase's son, Kian Johnson, also was in Billy Elliot with him at the same time. So it's kind of cool that they worked together on Broadway and are now doing a show together. But it was just announced last week that Kyle Dean Massey is going to be joining the cast as an openly gay singer-songwriter in Nashville. One of the main cast members is a closeted gay male country star. So I'm sure that those two will have some interactions. But it is pretty cool to see a couple different generations of Broadway stars getting some time on an ABC drama that's you know, pretty successful. If you would have told me that there was a semi-musical drama about country music on ABC and it was going to run for a little bit, I would have been a little surprised. But it's nice to see these Broadway folks getting some national publicity on a weekly basis.
Yeah, it's I think that it's been helped along by the success of the musicals on television of recent, the last couple of years.
Sure. Well, there's been a lot of that. I mean, and not just not just on TV, but we've obviously seen some movie ones as well. It's nice that musicals in general, whether they are, you know, Broadway musicals or something even like Glee or Smash or Nashville, the idea of blurring the line between drama being told through song and drama being told through dialogue, it's nice to see that getting some respect on television and movies and with a greater whole or with the public as a whole, because it just gives more legitimacy to what people are doing on stage in New York and around the country.
All right. And certainly not a musical, but a television show with lots of stars, Broadway stars, and it is Madam Secretary.
Yeah, this is a show that debuted in the fall on CBS. It stars Taya Leone, who is kind of a former CIA operative who, after the death of the Secretary of State, is elevated to that role. But besides Taya Leone, there is a host of Broadway stars: Bebe Neuwirth, Patina Miller, Keith Carradine, Eric Bergen, Tim Daly, Sebastian Arculus, if I'm probably mispronounced his name, and the one guy who is on every TV show, and he is on every show that has to do with politics, and I can never pronounce his name. Maybe you can. Zeljko Ivanic.
Oh, yeah. I've gotten that wrong before. Yes.
Yeah, he was the chief of staff on House of Cards. Now he's the chief of staff on Madam Secretary. I think he was on 24 at one point.
Yes.
But he's another good Broadway guy, and it's a good show. It's definitely in the CBS procedural vein, where every week she's got some sort of diplomatic crisis to deal with. But there is a little bit more of a longer conspiracy theory that she's dealing with as well. So it's a fun show. It doesn't live up to the West Wing level of political drama that I think a lot of people thought it might. A lot of people try to compare it to a mix of Homeland and the West Wing. And I don't know that it gets there, but it sits in a nice CBS niche where if you like the other shows on CBS, this one will probably scratch that itch while also giving you a chance to see some Broadway faces on a weekly basis.
We have to get Zeljko back to Broadway. His last appearance on Broadway was in 2006 at the Caine Mutiny Court Martial. He also did the Survivor, Brighton Beach Memoirs, Lou, two Shakespearean actors, The Glass Menagerie in 1994, and The Pillow Man.
So he's done a lot.
Yeah, so he's got seven Broadway credits, but the last one, 2006, come back.
And I know.
It's a Tony Award nominee for Best Actor in a Play for Caine Mutiny Court Martial. He got a Tony... did he win? No, he was a nominee, all nominees. So he got nominated for Brighton Beach, two Shakespearean actors, Caine Mutiny Court Martial. So we got to get him back on Broadway.
Yeah. And maybe not playing a presidential chief of staff this time.
Exactly. Well, you know, we get some sort of presidential show on Broadway again. We'll see if we can get him back there.
It was at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Yes.
If that show ever gets revived, I know who to call.
All right. So, Matt, change gears now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You went to go see Newsies at the Dr. Phillips Center for the Performing Arts.
I did.
Tell us about the Newsy tour.
Well, I opened up my review on Broadway World about it and admitting that I am not in the typical demographic for Newsies. I think anybody who's kind of followed the trajectory of that show knows about the fanzies, know that there's a lot of young women who love the show. So there was a bit of cynicism that I had when I went in thinking, you know, is this show just going to be, you know, a bunch of fluff, a bunch of dancing, which I love, but is it going to have much more to it? And I was surprised at how much that cynicism was melted away by the show. It is by far not a perfect show. There are plenty of things to nitpick about it, and I did a little bit in my review, but as a whole, it was a lot of fun. I mean, it was joyful. It had heart. There was a lot of you know, with a Harvey Fierstein, you know, script, it's not a surprise that there's some political connections with it. But I enjoyed it. The stars were great. Dan DeLuca as Jack Kelly and Stephanie Stiles as Kate. They were really enjoyable. I was surprised at how much I liked it. Obviously, the dancing is fantastic. The singing was good. The set is great. I'm assuming it was the same set that was seen on Broadway. So if you are around the country and enjoy a good, fun show with a whole lot of dancing, if Newsies comes to town, this would be one to go check out.
Great. So what have you got coming up?
Well, with the Oscars coming up later this month over at Broadway World, we've got a lot of Oscar coverage stuff going on. So there's not as many theater people nominated this year as has been in years past, and definitely not as many as we've had in the Emmys in years past. But there's some theater people that are nominated in some different categories. So we'll have some features on them. We'll do a lot of coverage the week of the Oscars. And then after that, the next show coming to Dr. Phillips is Motown. So I'll be seeing that in the second week of March, I think. Yeah, second or third week of March. So that's the next Broadway tour coming through. So other than that, we're just kind of seeing what's going on around the entertainment world and getting you the information as quickly as we can.
I've been talking in the last couple of months about Motown and that they closed it on Broadway. They're planning to bring it back to Broadway. I saw an article in Cranes New York, an interview with Kevin McCullum, and his motivation behind this, closing it and opening it, is that he has figured some way to save money, but they didn't say how. I think that they're going to double some roles or do something with the orchestra or something like that, but he's planning on saving a ton of money every week, and that's one of the big impetuses behind closing it, reworking it, and reopening it. So I wonder if they'll do that on the road or if they're going to do it here in New York and just open it up cold.
Yeah, I'll keep an eye for that and try to compare it to the Broadway cast list to see if there's more people or less people than there originally was. That was just a weird situation. You know, when they announced that, I was shocked because while it wasn't doing Book of Mormon or Wicked numbers in the grosses every week, it was doing pretty well. It seemed to be up around the $750,000 to $1 million a week range, and if memory serves correctly, and to announce that it was closing was a surprise. And if Kevin McCollum and the rest of the producers can get it back up and save a little money, I guess good for them. I feel bad for the people who might have lost their jobs because of it. But you know, I'm still a little skeptical that it'll ever come back, just because you don't really see that other than things like Hair, where it closed on Broadway and then the touring cast came in and did a sit down in New York for a month or two or whatever a couple of years ago. You just don't see something like that, at least not in my memory. Can you think of anything else that's done something like this?
Not off the top of my head, no.
Yeah. So I'll keep an eye out and see if I can notice any differences between the structure of the show on tour and the structure on the show in Broadway. And we'll let you know in March.
All right.
Haircut that costs a quarter. Regular beat for the star reporter. And straight punk, she's the king of New York.
Who the fuck? I'm the king of New York.
We were sunk, pale and pitiful.
So I think that this is a first for us, but I'm not sure. Michael and Peter both got a chance to see Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike, but different productions in a different theater. So different states. Peter got to see it in the great state of New Jersey with the Paper Mill Playhouse. Production is running through February 15th. And Michael got to see it at the Engman Theater in Northport. That's the John W. Engman Theater in Northport out on Long Island, which runs through March 8th. So Peter, why don't you start us off with your production?
Fine. Yes, the Paper Mill Playhouse has some nice names in it, to be certain. One is Michelle Park, whom we all admire, and Mark Nelson also. So they are playing the roles that were originally done by Christine Nielsen and David Hyde Pierce. Now, what's really intriguing about this production is that Michelle Park is not remotely interested in replicating Christine Nielsen's performance. She knows that Christine Nielsen is Christine Nielsen, and there's no sense in giving a carbon copy of that. So it's not as flamboyant a performance, but I do believe it's more in tune with what a real human being is like. So I liked her amazingly. I do believe Mark Nelson is one of our finest actors, and he's very good at not exuding self-pity in this play. And of course, he has that wonderful monologue in the second act. Now, you know, that's what really turned the crowd in this show to make them happy. And for the longest time, I was wondering, why is Paper Mill doing this show? There were more empty seats there than I've seen in a long time. You know, there are 1,200 seats. I dare say that even though Vanya is getting the most productions of any play this year, that this is the biggest house it will be playing. That's my guess. So the New Jersey audience didn't get those references to Chekhov. You know, I can't remember the Italian word for window, lots of silence for things like that. And much of the humor, the offbeat humor of Chris Durang, didn't seem to resonate. But I'm telling you, when Vanya's marvelous tirade that that mentions Howdy Doody and Annette Funicello and Fulton J. Sheen and Pussy Galore, when that speech came through, all the baby boomers and the members of the Greatest Generation, and yes, there are still plenty of those who go to Paper Mill, finally relaxed and said, oh, this is, thank God, you know, I'm going to have a good time after all. It's like Rose says in Gypsy, you know, if you give you a big finish, they'll forgive you anything. And that's what happened here, because this comes very late in the play, of course. If you don't know this monologue, really, it's worth going to see the show just to hear the monologue, especially if you come from the generation that Vanya comes from. He's definitely Chris Durang's mouthpiece, because he even alludes to how old he was when he first saw Goldfinger and heard of Pussy Galore, and it's the exact age that Chris Durang was at that point in time. He points out that he didn't get the joke in Pussy Galore. Today, 3-year-olds get it. You know, they just learned to walk and they know that they get the joke, and that's very funny. So it's too big a house for the show. Sit close if you go. It's virtually a replication of the original production. I won't be surprised if I learn that they bought the set from the production, because it looks exactly the same to me. And if there's any different blocking, I didn't notice. I saw it twice, once at the New House and once on Broadway. So I feel I'm reasonably in tune with it. And I really felt everything was in the exact same place that it was on Broadway. So if you missed it on Broadway, and you know, when you think of it, a lot of people did, because really only a scant, 3 months after it won the Tony, it was gone. That usually doesn't happen. I mean, usually a Tony-winning play gets to play more than that, unless it was a limited engagement to begin with. But you know, a lot of people probably did want to see it and couldn't get to it. So if you sit in the first 5 rows, 6 rows, 8 rows maybe, dead center, you'll be all right. And frankly, I think you're going to be able to get those seats based on what I saw attendance-wise at Paper Mill.
All right, so let's jump over to the other state. Michael, tell us what you think of your production.
Well, I saw it at the Engelmann, where in Northport, as James said, Northport, Long Island, which I've seen a few other shows there, and it's a lovely theater. First of all, the theater itself, a renovated movie theater, much more intimate than Paper Mill, and therefore much more well suited to this play in that respect. The main reason I picked this production to go see, because as Peter said, there are so many around everywhere, including the Paper Mill, and a lot within a stone's throw. But this one has Sean Young in the role of Masha. Sean Young, who was a very big movie star for a few years in such films, leading roles in such films as Blade Runner and No Way Out, and really several others. I all different kinds of stories as to why she sort of faded, but whatever, and I'm not sure why she is in this particular production. I don't know if she lives out there. I don't know if she's friends with someone who runs the theater or maybe the director, but for whatever reason, she is playing Masha, and I am delighted to say that she's absolutely fantastic in
it. Oh, good.
I mean, she has very, very little, if any, stage experience whatsoever, aside from the fact of not having acted in quite some years. Mm. So I was actually amazed at how at home she seemed on stage. She was very confident. She seemed to get the character extremely well. And it's perfect in the sense that the character is supposed to be a movie star who and specifically a movie star who well, in the play, she's kind of, I guess, a star of you know, like kind of mindless blockbuster type movies sort of things, not rather than a, you know, like a Meryl Streep type of actress. Mm. She really was wonderful on stage, and I have to say, I think she's the only one who really got the very, very tricky, quirky Durang humor. All of the cast, everyone was completely professional, and you know, you would never say that any of them were bad, but they and or the director didn't quite get the very, very unique, quirky Durang humor. I think a few months ago I mentioned that I had seen a production of Beyond Therapy off Broadway, and it was very much the same thing. Very creditable performances, very, very professional, but just not quite that magic that people like Christine Nielsen and David Hyde Pierce, and apparently Julie White, whom I did not see when she took over for Sigourney Weaver. But it's not everyone can do it. It's very, very special kind of humor. So in this production, I thought Sean Young just really, really got it. And it was a lovely production in terms of the set. It's interesting, Peter, the stage is not very high at all at the Engelman.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. And so what they did is they actually did not have a second level. Now, I don't think that you actually see a second level.
No, they just go up the stairs. Yeah,
yeah, but they didn't even have stairs here. They just kind of walked off stage left or stage right. Sure. It was the rest of the house supposed to be. But, no, you know, that didn't really make any difference at all. So, yeah, I really would be. It's interesting because it was the greatest success in Christopher Durang's career, certainly in terms of. Well, I mean, it was his, first of all, it was his only Broadway success, and it won him a Tony, and it is being done everywhere, as we've said. But it's still very special, and so I'm glad that it's being done everywhere so people can sample his own brand of comic genius. But I do hope that, that a lot of the productions are able to tap into that, because it's so, so difficult. I would be very hesitant to, if someone offered me to direct the play, as much as I love it, I would be hesitant because I think it's very, very tricky.
Did the Northport audience respond? Oh, were they much the same as mine?
They did. It's so surefire. That monologue in Act Two is absolutely surefire. They really loved that. But there were quite a few laughs in Act One. It took a while to get going. The whole bit with the breaking the coffee cups didn't quite work. They didn't know quite what to make of that. but then it kind of found its stride after that. One interesting thing is that the role of Cassandra, which to me, first of all, I think that's one of the biggest flaws in the play, because I still don't know why he stuck this figure from Greek tragedy into this spoof of Chekhov. But anyway, she is played at the Engelman by a woman named Isabel Santiago, who did it with a, you know, quite a thick Spanish accent. And to me, that made it inherently funnier than the lady who did it on Broadway, who just did it a whole different way. So that was that was a plus of this production. And Kevin Parisot was a much more. Do you know him?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, he's done quite a bit. He was lovely as Vanya, not as funny, but just really inhabited the character, very 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 grounded, and I think the monologue, it really struck home with people because it was like, you know, their next door neighbor saying it, very much that's how it came across. So I'm very glad I saw the production and. I am, as I said, I'm glad the play is being done so much, even though it's really quite tricky.
James, by all means, stop me, edit me, if you need to, because I may have brought this up before. But talking about Durang's humor, did I ever talk about the fact when I saw his work when he was a sophomore at Harvard? Have we talked about that?
I don't think so.
Yeah, he did a musical called The Greatest Musical Ever Sung, and he knows whenever I run into him, he's going to hear about it because, you know, it was done in a small little theater, not even a theater, a room, really, at Harvard. Anyway, The Greatest Musical Ever Sung, is, as the title seems to imply, is a musical about the New Testament, and as a result, Durang forbidden Broadway the show by taking famous show songs and applying them with new lyrics and to suit the New Testament. So as a result, when Jesus comes in on Palm Sunday, everybody is singing, "Who took the sins right out of the whore? Jesus. Who took the pus right out of the sore? Jesus." And so on. When Mary gives birth to Jesus in the stable, the chorus comes on. Mary's off stage. "They say that having a child is wonderful." And off stage you hear Mary go, "Ah!" Right then and there, you knew that this was a guy with a terrific imagination, even though he was in his sophomore year. And many would say, well, he was a sophomore. No wonder it turned out so sophomorically. But boy, has he had the last laugh in a long and distinguished career. So nice guy, too, by the way. So I'm delighted for his success.
Oh, that's a great story. It. I love hearing the stories about finding these huge talents before they were big hits. I think that you had Peter. I think you've told us about a young Al Pacino that you saw before he was famous.
Yeah, in Awake and Sing at the Charles Playhouse. Yeah, sure. Yeah, that is the fun of it. You know, that's the nice thing about being old, you know, seeing Stockard Channing. She was Susan Channing, Tommy Lee Jones playing Coriolanus. By the way, when eBay started, I decided let me test the waters by seeing if anybody wants my Tommy Lee Jones playbill for Coriolanus at Harvard University from 1968. It was a piece of paper folded over, and some Tommy Lee Jones freak bought it for $157.50. So I'm very glad that I went to see Coriolanus that night.
on a related note, the aforementioned David Hyde Pierce, I saw on Broadway in Beyond Therapy.
Yeah, he was the waiter.
Tiny part of the waiter. And now he's become a Durang specialist. So so it's wonderful when things like that. Some people, actors and directors, some people get him and some people don't. And Beyond Therapy was a huge flop on Broadway. I loved it.
No, I was very surprised it didn't do better. Yeah. Very surprised, but it didn't. Yeah. David Hyde Pierce, by the way, tells the story of when he was at home with his mother watching Frasier. She would say to him, you look like you could be his brother, you know.
And really? Wow.
Yeah, and how many times, you know, our mothers do that type of thing to us, and usually the suggestions are worthless or they don't understand. So in this case, it turned out to be very accurate. And what a surprise that he did get the part. And, of course, he was on his way after that.
You know, back in the day when I was pursuing acting on television, my mom would say, "Oh, that Friends thing is so funny. You should go do Friends."
Yeah, this is exactly what I'm talking about.
And I'm like, oh, you know, of course, that's never has crossed my mind. I should just go and do that. Okay.
I'm calling them up tomorrow and let them know I'm coming, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And in fact, it was very funny because my dad's family from the neighborhood knew Tony Danza, and they thought for sure they could they could get me in an audition because they knew Tony Danza. Okay.
Well, I'm sorry. I'm sorry that Tony show isn't doing better.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and what I noticed, I decided to do some statistics to see about Jason Robert Brown's career. And again, worthwhile career. Don't misunderstand me, but no composer lyricist who has won 2 Tony Awards has had shows run as short a period of time as Jason Robert Brown, and by far, 2-time Tony winners. Okay, so his shows have run 85 and 100 performances, respectively, Parade and Bridges of Madison County, which averages to 93 performances each. The closest to him who won 2 Tony Awards for composer lyricist is Murray Estin, who wrote 9 in Titanic. Well, 9 ran 729, and Titanic ran 804 for an average of 766. So the second shortest running 2-time Tony winner is 10 times longer in runs than Jason Robert Brown. Wow. You know, and I just wonder, since Honeymoon in Vegas does not look promising in terms of paying back its investment, I'm not saying it's closing tomorrow. All I'm saying is it doesn't look promising. I just wonder if he's going to get discouraged and say, all right, look, you know, Broadway just doesn't appreciate me. I've got to do something else with my life. I'm not saying I hope that happens. I'm not remotely saying I hope that happens. However, we have to face the reality that on Broadway, he has not found a public.
I don't. Yeah. Have you heard Jason's his album Wearing Somebody Else's Clothes?
No, I know what you're talking about, but no, I never have.
Mm-hmm. There's a song on it called Getting Out. And it's exactly what you're saying. He was angry and fed up with the New York scene, and he left. And he did that. He went to Italy. Mm. How long did he go to Italy? He went to Italy for a long time. And then came back and recharged his batteries and jumped back into it. But what were you going to say, Michael?
Oh, just that at the risk of state, I don't know if this is incredibly obvious, but someone just today I read, someone said, and I think this is true, that it really is not that people don't respond to his work. It's just that for whatever reason, they don't necessarily respond to the things he chooses to musicalize.
Disagree with that.
You never can tell what, of course, you know, if we could tell, we'd all be millionaires. But
well, sure, but it must be very painful to get the review that you get in the New York Times, which used to be an e-ticket to success, you know, and to have that happen. I mean, that opening night party must have been pretty joyous. You know, I dare say there's not as much joy now. And I'm sorry, you know, and I hate even to mention this from the vantage point, but it's I hope it doesn't sound like I'm dancing on anybody's grave. I'm really not. Really very sympathetic to it. I like the show. I wish it will turn around. I hope it does. But the facts don't look good at the moment.
And the thing is, you also can never know for sure. I mean, is it seems to me that a tremendous amount of it just might be what seems to be the horrendous decision to open when they opened and to preview for 2 months.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't know for sure. I mean,
no, I don't either, but
if it opened in March, would everything have been different? If it had opened last year, you know, and it had more momentum, quote unquote, from Paper Mill, would that have made it all the difference in the world? Or is it just that people don't want to see Honeymoon in Vegas because they don't really know what that is? I mean, the movie wasn't exactly Gone with the Wind in terms of, you know, but you know, neither was, well, I mean, we could think of lots of other musicals based
and
on
and
movies.
Let's face it, this is not the stupidest thing we've, the previewing for a long time is not the stupidest thing we've seen, because the Seattle Seahawks final play yesterday was the stupidest thing you've ever seen. But that's another story entirely, too. I know that the feeling must have been, let's preview for 2 months, we'll get this great word of mouth, and then we'll be ready to show when we open. But that didn't quite turn out to be true.
So Ken Davenport, Ken Davenport, the producer, has started a podcast called The Producer's Perspective. That's an offshoot from his blog.
Right.
And this week he had Drew Hodges from Spotco on. And it's very funny because Drew talks about how if the show's a hit, then the marketing is considered genius. But if the show is not a hit, then the marketing gets blamed. And I think that's true, and I'm guilty of that. And I said that about Bridges of Madison County, that I thought that the marketing campaign for Bridges of Madison County was terrible, and the marketing is what puts the butts in the seats. You know, whether or not they like it is after the fact of when they bought the ticket. So it's going to be – I really hope that they have enough money to keep it open and run it through the Tonys and pick up a few Tonys and get a bump. Let's hope.
Be nice.
But yeah. Just to clarify, I'm not necessarily saying the marketing. I'm just saying the timing and the decision to preview for that long. And I'm sure, Peter, they must have said exactly what you said to themselves. But on the other hand, I always feel like, you know, and there's also the argument that nowadays that most audiences other than the New York theater audience, whatever's left of it, don't really make that much of a distinction between previews and actual performances anymore. And I think, but while I think that's true, I also think it's true that somehow a show never gets as much attention as when it's actually open. And so maybe it's just that, but maybe it's not. I don't know.
All right. So let's move over to what's quickly becoming one of our favorite off-Broadway theater houses is 59 East 59, where Peter got to see The Road to Damascus. So Peter, why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is a good idea for a play. It deals with the Pope. Pope Augustine, by the way, our first black pope. And he knows that there's a lot of strife going on in the world. And there's a particular part of Syria that's really having a lot of bombings and destruction and all that goes with that. And it's a war zone. And, well, the obvious solution is for him to go there. Because if he goes there, nobody would dare do anything. I mean, they would just drop their guns in peace because he's the pope. Really? That's what the play is about. Is the Pope naive? Is he courageous? Does he feel that if he goes, that he might die, but it would be worth it to make a statement? I mean, we're really talking nuclear stuff here. So that is a very sharp idea for a play, and I wish that the director, Michael Parver, could have made it seem far more exciting. There's a sterility about the mood, and the stakes didn't seem to be very high. We've all known directors who snap their fingers, you know, meaning like go faster, go faster, go faster. And and you wanted to do that quite a bit during this play. It had to feel more immediate. It was almost directed as if it were a drawing room comedy by Noel Coward. Not that it's funny and not that it should be, but the ease with which everybody was talking when world calamity type of events are being discussed was amazing to me. So I think it's a better play than it came across here at 59 East 59th. Tom Dulack is really a very fine writer, and this is a real departure for him. He doesn't usually write this type of play, but The Road to Damascus is solid, and I'm looking forward to the next production of it.
Peter, was this in the main stage space there?
It was. Yes, indeed. You never. Yeah, by the way, the rule of thumb at 59 East 59. If it starts on the hour, it's in the big space. Some shows start at 8:15, 8:30. You're going to be in a much smaller space if you're in a show that starts at either one of those times. There are three spaces there. And yes, the main stage is the nicest space, nicely raked, nice part of town, you know, good salad bar next door. And so 59th East 59th has become a nice destination. And they do Primary Stages to thank a bit for that. I mean, even though Primary Stages has left there, their subscription base did get there during the years that they were there, and people were discovering it. And, you know, once you get people walking through the doors, that helps a lot. They get used to it, and it doesn't seem like an intimidating idea to go to the theater. I don't know what I'm going to see when I get there. What's the neighborhood like? It's the nicest neighborhood, needless to say, near Park Avenue. I do like going there quite a bit, though I will admit I like when I'm in the main stage most of all. And I was glad to see the Road to Damascus got the main stage for this show. So Mel Johnson Jr., by the way, I think really could be good as the Pope if he had somebody snapping fingers behind him. It was funny, by the way, to see a Pope taking a curtain call. You know, he's dressed in all that white with the little skull cap and all that. You know, there he is taking a bow. You don't see the Pope taking a bow. You know what I mean? Not that I know of. Maybe I got to pay more attention to what's going on in Vatican City. But
all right, Michael, to wrap up the discussion today, Michael got a chance to attend a talkback with Kim Cattrall for PBS's Shakespeare Uncovered series. So, Michael, tell us about that.
Yes, I don't know if either of you are familiar with the series. They've already had one season, and it's just starting its second season, Shakespeare Uncovered. And what it consists of is basically really wonderful actors and pretty big stars in most cases. Each show is dedicated to one play, and the star will discuss it and interview other actors about it. There will be clips from various stage and or film productions of it. Also documentary footage of people walking around the Globe Theater in Stratford-on-Avon. It's the cream of the crop. They have people this season coming up, this current season. They have Christopher Plummer doing King Lear, David Harewood doing Taming of the Shrew, and Kim Cattrall's play is Antony and Cleopatra, which she has done in London or at Stratford, somewhere over there. And she said that she'd love to do it in New York, if possible. There was a production just last year. Is that right?
Yeah.
At the Public, which I missed.
I didn't see it either.
Yeah. But so it really was great. And she did a talk back with some of the series creators, and she's very articulate. It's so interesting when someone, you know, that articulate and really, I mean, a serious actress here becomes famous for something as relatively frivolous as Sex in the City. And she talked about that too. And, you know, of course, that it's a double-edged sword to a certain extent, because she said she felt she had to go. She was born in Liverpool. I don't know if you guys know that. She actually grew up, spent a lot of her youth in Canada, but she said, I felt I had to go back to England after Sex and the City in order to be basically taken seriously as an actress again. And so she did. And so it was really great to see her and hear her thoughts on the play. And it's a really, really is a wonderful series, and it's PBS, you know, so it's not even,
gonna be, right.
It's not even, and it's not even, yeah, it's not even premium cable.
Right. Yeah.
So do try to catch it. It's fantastic.
While we're talking about Shakespeare, let me recommend, the New York Shakespeare Exchanges production of Titus Andronicus, which maybe should be called Bloody Bloody Titus Andronicus. Shakespeare's 1593 hit is perhaps his bloodiest of all. I mean, people lose a lot in this play. And so the director, Russ Williams, knows this. He didn't want to gross us out too much. And he has a very clever metaphor for blood for most of the play. But we don't get near to it because blood does show up by the time it's done. But, you know, if you ever want to see this really performed play, but you can't stand the sight of blood, well, this is the one to see. It closes this weekend, but I do think it's worth seeing. So keep that in mind.
Yeah, you know, I have a friend in that, a wonderful actor, Vince Gatton. And I'm love to try to get there. It's, isn't it down at here? Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. It's Spring Street or one street over and Sixth Avenue. Yeah, the E train goes there. I really thought it was very erudite and very tasteful for a Titus Andronicus. That's what I like most of all. On a unit set, of course. I did some math again and found out that in my lifetime I have seen 246 Shakespeare productions. And I have discovered that of those 246, 246 of them were on a unit set. Does anybody do Shakespeare with realistic sets? Is that ever going to happen? I'd love to see it. I'd love
in
to
the
see,
park. Sometimes, know, yeah.
Yeah, that's, but even that's a unit set. You know, I mean, they're lovely sets. And the one for All's Well That Ends Well in 1978, yeah, was one of the finest sets I'd ever seen. I went five times to that production, and not just because of the set, believe me. But anyway, I wonder if anybody ever does them on sets that were designed like, say, a 60s musical. I'd love to see a Shakespeare done like that, you know, with different rooms. And But it never does. Never. So, anyway.
All right. So, let's wrap up for the evening. If you stick around, we'll talk a little bit of trivia. But before we do that, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many other ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app. It's an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device. That way, we can be streamed directly to you. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, Michael, or me can be found on the show page at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things that we've talked about. So, Peter, even though you're not really with us this week...
I'm not against you, James.
Yeah. Well, that's very true. Thank you for that. Let's get the answer for last week's trivia question.
Well, the question was, what does England use for George Spelvin, the name that is often used as a pseudonym, or in movies, Alan Smithy? And the answer is Walter Plinge. That's the one they use when somebody doesn't want to be identified as part of the cast or the crew. So Walter Plinge, now you know.
Well, I wonder if maybe some entrepreneur out there can print up business cards to say, I'm Walter Plinge, and he can give it out at bars to women that he likes to pick up.
Speaking of women, I'm going to ask readers if they know if there is a female equivalent to this. Now, of course, there was a porno star named Georgina Spelvin back in the 70s. Lord knows where she is today. But I've never heard a female equivalent in theater that they use when a woman doesn't want to be identified. So I have no idea what that is. So if any readers out there and listeners out there know the answer, I'd be very grateful to hear it.
That is very interesting. I hadn't thought about that. So let's move forward on to this week's trivia question. What is it?
Well, once upon a time, a play opened to truly putrid reviews, the type of reviews that close you in one night. But the producer said, no, I'm just going to drop all tickets to $1, and let's see if anybody comes. And the show sold out for 2 weeks. They weren't making expenses, so they had to close. But the moral of the story is, if theater tickets are cheap enough, people will come and see anything. So what's the name of the play?
All right. Well, if you have the name of that, please go to BroadwayRadio.com, and you'll have contact information for Peter and for me and for Michael, and let us know what your answer is. So, Peter, we will see you next week. Thanks for dropping in.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.